Welcome everyone to The Third Degree. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Jess.
And in the studio today we have Owen Pascoe from ACF. We've got a couple of stories. A bit later on we'll be talking about the Northern Territory intervention. A bit timely because yesterday was International Human Rights Day. But for today, Jess, what have we got first?
Well, we're starting up with the Poznan talks, and we'll be talking to Owen about those in a moment. But the Alliance of Small Island States, or AISIS, which includes countries most at risk from climate change impacts, have made a plea for the world to commit to a strong action plan on climate change at the United Nations talks in Poznan, Poland at the moment. Many island states such as Tuvalu and Kiribati risk being submerged by climate change induced sea level rises. Other nations like Fiji risk losing important agricultural land. So OSIS is calling for atmospheric pollution to be reduced to 350 parts per million. That would mean all developed nations would need to reduce emissions by more than 40% by 2020. Yesterday, Australia was awarded first in the Fossil of the Day Awards for countries which attempt to undermine the progress of the negotiations at Poznan. This morning, I spoke to John Hepburn, climate campaigner with Greenpeace.
The key issue with the talks in Poznan is the development of a shared vision, which means putting some numbers into the negotiating text so that hopefully by the end of next year we can have a global agreement to cut emissions. Now, Australia's been stalling at every step of the way and has been arguing against some of the agreements that Australia actually made last year in the Bali conference. So there's been a lot of talk about the Bali range, which is 25 to 40% cuts by 2020, which is really the bare minimum that the world needs, the developed countries need to commit to if we're going to have any chance of stopping global climate change. And Australia's been arguing against that. It's really quite appalling behaviour.
So what has Australia been arguing?
We've been arguing for no numbers to be included in there. We've been sort of undermining that 25 to 40% range. We've been calling for forestry offsets to be included so that, you know, countries like Australia don't really need to cut our industrial emissions. We can just offset all our emissions through, you know, stopping forest degradation in other poor countries. So we've basically been stalling, not putting anything down on the table at all, really, and just playing a generally negative role in the negotiations, which is what we expected under the Howard government, but we certainly expect a lot more than that from Kevin Rudd.
And what is the outcome of that if we walk away from Poznan without any firm agreements or firm targets?
Well, the risk is that it will delay the development of the international agreement. So the idea of Poznan is really to come up with a shared vision, a negotiating mandate, so the global community can then finalise an international agreement at the Copenhagen meeting at the end of 2009. It's looking increasingly like that agreement not happening at the end of next year because countries like Australia have been obstructing, which might mean that it will take an extra 6 months to develop an international agreement. We don't know yet. The negotiations are still underway, but certainly Australia has been playing a very destructive role.
Can you tell me about what the Alliance of Small Island States, or AISIS, has how they've responded to Australia's behaviour at the Poznan talks?
The OASIS group is the small island states who, of course, are going to be the most and soonest affected by climate change. We're looking at some countries that, you know, may well need to evacuate and move their entire country. They've been calling for global temperatures to be capped at a maximum of 1.5 degrees warming over pre-industrial levels. And really to bring it down as low as possible. They've been playing a really important leadership role, speaking out strongly on the issue of targets and calling for countries like Australia to be cutting emissions by at least 25%, but up to 40% by 2020. And Australia at this point have not been responding to them and have basically just been ignoring that target range. So it's been good to see those small island states coming out with such a strong position on developed countries and their need to cut emissions, because we haven't seen that in negotiations previously.
Can you tell me about the Fossil of the Day awards that have been handed out at Poznan?
So the Climate Action Network is a group of all the NGOs that have been lobbying in the climate negotiations for many years. They issue an award every day to the countries that, or the country of the countries that are doing, are performing the worst and are doing the most to undermine action on climate change. Australia won the Fossil of the Day award today, or yesterday, which is really for not agreeing to that Bali range of the 25 to 40% cuts. And Australia is really trying to undermine that range. So we won first place. We'd won a couple of, third place or fourth place earlier on in the week. But it just shows that in the eyes of the world and the eyes of the international community, Australia has been playing the most destructive role of any country in these global talks.
Has there been any official response to this by the Australian government?
No official response, but it looks like Penny Wong is facing increasing pressure because, what they're doing in Poznan is the complete opposite of what they're saying they're doing, and it's the complete opposite of what they said they would do when we elected them a year ago to take action on climate change. So this meeting, I think, is starting to reveal the hypocrisy of the Rudd and Wong climate agenda, which is, at this point, it's looking almost as bad as John Howard, to be honest, which is, it's difficult to say that, but it's true. Like it's what we're looking at.
Can I ask what room is available in the Poznan talks for small island states to make their claim about rising sea levels and such?
The small island states have, they have access to the plenaries, as do any ministers from any countries. So there's been some good speeches from the delegates, and now the ministerial meeting is starting, I think, today over in Poznan. We're expecting to hear some good speeches from the ministers from the small island states as well. So they, as countries that are part of the United Nations, they have as much of a voice as any country, in theory, but, obviously it's the bigger countries that tend to dominate, but we're seeing that the small island states in this meeting have been taking up a much larger share of the debate, which is very good. It's important, and they have a strong moral weight because they will be the most affected by climate change.
And that was John Hepburn from Greenpeace. But at the moment, we're joined by Owen Pascoe from the Australian Conservation Foundation to talk a little bit more about Poznan, the climate talks that are happening in Poland at the moment. So I was wondering if you could start by maybe just highlighting again the significance of these talks in the lead up to the Copenhagen talks next year, but also over the next decade or so.
Yeah, sure. Well, John's given a really good summary there. As he was sort of pointing out, they have these talks every year, so they have them once every 12 months, and the chance for all the parties that signed on to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to get together and try and move things forward. So the big meeting that everyone's talking about, of course, is the Copenhagen meeting next year in 2009. The Bali meeting was quite significant in 2007, just after our federal election, where Australia ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Poznan is really the midpoint between the Bali negotiations and the big negotiations in Copenhagen. So what we really need to see here is progress. We really need to see countries getting on board and taking steps forward to get us closer to a global agreement that will actually avoid dangerous climate change.
But what are we seeing?
Well, we are seeing some slow movement, unfortunately. We're really not seeing the urgency that we need to see in this debate. I've just been on the phone with a couple of people in Poznan this morning, and we have had word that the crucial 2020 targets, which everyone is talking about at the moment, and which the Rudd government will announce its 2020 target next Monday on the 15th of December. Now, that's a big issue for us nationally, but also a big issue internationally. And we've just had word from Poznan that basically the position that's been taken forward is exactly the same position that was put at Bali. So there hasn't been any progress on that 2020 targets, that 25 to 40% range, in 12 months. So if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change, we can't afford to move at a snail's pace.
I mean, this has been covered as quite a big thing of Penny Wong and the Australian delegation of arriving at Poznan without the targets. They're holding the white paper or holding back the release of the white paper until next Monday, following the talks. I mean, how significant is that? What kind of message does that actually send?
Well, it really does send the signal that Australia isn't moving forward quickly enough. So we really need to see them on next Monday do what they haven't done so far, which is to announce a target that's within that 25 to 40% range. Otherwise, we'll actually be holding back international negotiations, and we really need to be pushing them forward. If we understand the science of climate change and understand that Australia will perhaps be the most affected developed country from climate change, we stand to lose the Australian Alps, the snow cover there, the Great Barrier Reef, up to 92% of our irrigated agricultural industry in the Murray-Darling Basin. If we do understand that Australia is one of the worst affected, we must also understand that Australia's interest is in pushing forward these international negotiations and doing everything we can to encourage countries to come up with a workable and urgent global agreement.
But do you think it would have had to be quite an important reason for Australia to delay this announcement, or what do you think some of their reasoning would be to hold it off to a few days after the talk?
Well, it certainly sounds like there's been a lot of negotiation within government, and they've certainly had trouble landing on their final position. We hope that's because they're seriously considering the climate change science. However, of course, there has been a lot of pressure from businesses that would like us to see us slow down, like to see us take small targets. It won't really transform the Australian economy and create the green collar jobs that we need to see.
So this white paper is being released on Monday. What are the things for us to look out for as to see whether action is actually being taken?
Yeah, sure. Well, there'll be a couple of things. The first and major thing is these 2020 targets. That's the most crucial issue that will be decided and announced on Monday. So the government's committed to announcing a medium-term target range for 2020. So they'll announce the range that they'll be willing to see the Australian economy reduce emissions by that year. So we absolutely need to see that they're supporting what's being talked about internationally, which is this 25 to 40% reductions, and announce a target that's within that range. That's the biggest thing that we'll be seeing in the white paper. Of course, there'll be a lot of other details, because this is really the government's final policy position on the emissions trading scheme, which has been discussed all year by the Rudd government, but has been discussed since 1999 in Australia. Again, an example of quite slow progress. So, we're looking forward to actually seeing that locked down and moving forward. Now, we're hearing there were some good things in the Green Paper in terms of moving that debate forward on emissions trading in Australia. However, we're hearing some bad signals in the papers lately that the business lobbying has been really effective in Canberra in actually moving towards more free permit allocation, which is, going back to the basics here a little bit, but emissions trading basically requires people to hold a licence or a permit to put out carbon pollution. Now, if they have to pay for those, there's a really strong incentive for them to change their practices and reduce emissions. But if they get them for free, that incentive goes, and they don't have that same strong incentive to change their practices. Now, in the Green Paper, we had up to 20 to 30% of the permits being given away for free. We're hearing really strong signals that that's actually going to be increased in the White Paper. So we'll be certainly looking out for that. And if we don't get that right, then we won't be able to get Australia on a pathway to reduce our emissions. Now, just one more thing quickly on the White Paper as well. As important as the 2020 targets are, one of the things they'll be announcing is the actual fixed caps for the first 3 years of the emissions trading scheme. Now, that'll be really important. Now, Australia currently, under the international negotiations, got a really easy deal out of the Kyoto Protocol, which we eventually signed up to, that we could actually increase emissions by 8% above 1990 levels when everyone else was reducing theirs. So it would send a really strong signal internationally if we were actually to turn around that position, actually reduce our emissions below what we were required to do in the Kyoto Protocol, and really see emissions start falling from 2010 towards a pathway for a strong target by 2020.
But I guess you'd think that if that was to be announced, then the Australian delegation would arrive at Poznan with those targets and with those figures and really try to push for, you know, international support of taking that up. Is that the concern here?
Yeah, that's certainly true. If they had a strong target to announce, it would have been a lot better for them to announce it before the Poznan negotiations started. So it's not a good signal that they've delayed. However, another thing that I've been hearing from Poznan just this morning too is that 2020 target announcement is still really being watched. And that's probably the strongest thing we can do, not only to transform Australia's economy and move to a low-carbon future, but also send a really strong signal internationally and get progress towards an international agreement. Announcing a strong target would be the best thing we could do to achieve that.
So there's the white paper on Monday, and then this time next year there are the Copenhagen talks. People are banding around this figure of we have 10 years before runaway climate change. Can you break that down quite briefly for us?
Yeah, definitely. The urgency around climate change is hard to understate. We really are behind the times. We should have acted 10 years ago, but we have to move forward from this point. So what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been telling us, the IPCC, which has been widely quoted, is that we really need to see the absolute peak in global emissions by 2015. Now, the global emissions are still going up. Australia's emissions are still going up. The United States emissions are still going up. So we've got a lot of work to do to turn our emissions around and actually start reducing the global levels of emissions as quickly as possible. And we really need to see that peak of 2015 if we're to avoid the dangerous climate change effects that would arise if temperatures exceeded 1.5 or over 2 degrees. Particularly 2 degrees has been widely quoted as a threshold internationally, but we now see small island states and others increasingly recognising the need to go for these 1.5 degree targets. Now, the Copenhagen Agreement doesn't actually kick in till 2012. Up to 2012, we're dealing with the Kyoto period. So you've got this international agreement kicking in 2012, and you need to see global emissions peak by 2015. So you can really see why the Copenhagen negotiations are going to be really important.
But where is that year of 2015 actually, I mean, come from, and how, I guess, rigid is that in terms of stopping runaway climate change?
Sure. So it does come from the IPCC, and that's based around the scenarios that have been most widely talked about, which is stabilising emissions below 450 parts per million in the atmosphere by the end of the century. And that's what that 2015 peak lines up with. So if we were actually going to look at hitting the tougher targets that small island states and others are looking at, we'd actually need to see emissions peak and decline a lot quicker. So that would not just be a question of the peak, but also a question of how quickly it declines after that. So yeah, you would actually need to see stronger pathways than some of the IPCC numbers that have been put out so far.
Well, Owen's going to stay with us, but we just have a short story now.
Beautiful. So this is about the Northern Territory intervention that's still being rolled out in the Northern Territory. The crucial part of it is the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act. So it's actually a blemish on the Australian human rights record. Yesterday was International Human Rights Day, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. So I spoke with Alison Vivian, a senior researcher from the Jambana Indigenous House of Learning at UTS, about the elements of the Northern Territory intervention that breach these basic human rights.
Well, it's enormously broad, very comprehensive range of measures. The ones that are probably the most commonly known are the income quarantining that there's been a lot about that in the press, and the five-year leases. But in actual fact, there's a whole range of measures. There's removal of the Future Act regime under the Native Title Act. There's the infringement of various Indigenous property rights. And extraordinarily, there's actually powers for the minister to intervene in the operation of community organisations. But I guess most strikingly, and perhaps the one that is most egregious, is the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act.
Maybe you could talk a bit more about that. In particular, you've been working on with the Convention of the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So how does that link in with the intervention?
As you'd know, in human rights law, there's a whole range of different conventions that that kind of basically describe the human rights framework. In fact, it's 60 years ago today that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted. So if you think about that one, Article 1 of that was that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. So if you consider the criticisms that are often made of the intervention, the impact on self-esteem, the loss of faith in government, the loss of dignity, people talk about disempowerment and humiliation, then, you know, the kind of starting point of all human rights instruments was that one from 60 years ago, when Article 1, you'd have to say, is, you know, fairly squarely violated.
And it seems like the federal government is actively going against these human rights.
Well, that's right. As I mentioned, there's, you know, a number of human rights conventions. There's the ICCPR and the ICESCR. And there's also the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination. Now, Minister Macklin has said that, in fact, the measures of the intervention don't breach that convention because they are what are called special measures. Under the convention, state parties are entitled and, in fact, probably have an obligation to enact special measures to assist particular groups. And so Minister Macklin has said that the anti-intervention comes under that, but it's, I mean, that's an extraordinary claim, I think.
What sort of legal challenges are you taking to the intervention?
Minister Macklin has identified basically two elements of special measures, that there is benefit and that there is consent. Now, as you would know, when the Northern Territory Review Board, they handed down their report in the middle of October, they had some broad recommendations, and one of them was that there needed to be, fundamentally, there needed to be engagement with the Indigenous communities. That hadn't happened at all previously. And so Minister Macklin's kind of, in adopting that, the government has said that that's what they're going to do. She seems to be suggesting that that's going to fulfil that part of the special measures. And also, I mean, you would have heard last Friday there was the second report on the community stores came out, and the government is claiming that, therefore, because there's more fresh food being sold, that there is sufficient benefit. And I presume that they'll argue that that's sufficient to make these measures special measures.
And you don't think that that's sufficient?
Well, normally special measures would be a form of preferential treatment, so kind of affirmative action. That's why they're a bit controversial, in fact. And that's why, you know, there have been various state parties that have argued against special measures, because they say that, you know, affirmative action is in itself potentially racist. So I think that's quite ironic, really. But when you consider, as I mentioned before, there's a whole range of measures that are in the intervention. Quarantining is kind of the one that gets most focused on. But if you consider, for example, suspension of the Future Act process under the Native Title Act, under the Native Title Act, if there's going to be a development on land that is claimed or that there's an application over, then the claimants have the right to negotiate. That has been removed. I can't see any connection between that kind of regime and protection of children and child welfare. There's, as I mentioned before, the extraordinary powers for the minister to intervene in the operation of community organisations, to the point where the minister can dictate how the service runs and can actually confiscate and deal with assets. Again, I'm not sure what the connection there can be made to child welfare.
So it seems like the intervention legislation is actively breaching a lot of human rights. What kind of actions are you and or anyone else around the country taking on this front? Like, what kind of legal challenges are coming up next?
Well, I understand there's, because the Racial Discrimination Act has been suspended, there can't be actions in Australia. I mentioned before the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination. In fact, the racial discrimination was enacted to bring that international convention into Australian domestic law. So its suspension is itself a breach of the convention, because basically what it's saying, and the government's saying to the international community, is the convention doesn't apply here in those circumstances. There's a group of people who are subject to the intervention, who are living in prescribed areas, who are looking to bring an action in the Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, alleging the discriminatory nature of the intervention.
Right, so that's one avenue forth.
That's one avenue. There's a second avenue. There's a special rapporteur for Indigenous peoples. His specific role is to promote the rights of Indigenous peoples, but to investigate alleged violations of their rights. And so the primary document that he looks to is the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And so that's certainly something that people could do as well.
Okay, was there anything else that you're involved in or that you wanted to shed light on?
Well, they're the two main actions.
The two main ones?
Because the intervention is so broad and there's such a broad range of violations, if you like, I mean, it would even be possible to take an action to the Human Rights Committee.
That was Alison Vivian, a senior researcher at Jambana Indigenous House of Learning, UTS, talking about the human rights violations and a few legal challenges involved in the Northern Territory intervention. If you want to get involved, there's a couple of events this weekend to support human rights of Aboriginal people. In Sydney, there's a rally at Redfern, so meet 10 o'clock at Redfern Community Centre. See you there. And so we've still got Owen Pascoe in the studio. We've just got a final question. So we've been talking about the Poznan negotiations. What would you like to see? And are there any personal messages or specific messages you'd like to send?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Look, the most powerful thing that Australia could do for both for our country and to send a message to the international negotiations is to next Monday announce a target for 2020 to cut Australia's greenhouse pollution in towards the top end of that 25 to 40% range. So to set a target between 30 and 40%, if we could get a target up to those sort of levels, we'd really be sending a strong signal internationally and really increase the hope around the world to achieve an international agreement which will avoid dangerous climate change.
And just on that, there will be an action next Tuesday to tie in with the step-ins at MPs' offices around the country. But Climate Change Balmain are doing it at Tanya Plibersek's office in Favreau Street. So they're asking people to come with them and meet them from 12:09 to 1:01 in the afternoon. And that 52 minutes symbolises the 52 weeks until the international negotiations in Copenhagen next year. And the theme is water and flood. So they're asking people to bring snorkels, goggles, floaties, etc. Jenny Curtis from Climate Change Balmain Roselle, which is organising the action, will be our guest next week on the Third Degree. But that's about it. We have time for
today. Got to wrap up today. But thank you so much, Owen, for coming in and like breaking down what's going on in the climate change negotiations world. And
thanks very much, Hannah and Jess, and keep up the excellent work in this great program.
Aww.
And if you have any feedback or story ideas, please go to our 2SER website. That's the Third Degree.
Cool.
Okay, bye. We'll see you next week.